Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we've got a review of the new digital thriller, Profile. Plus, Rance Collins returns to the show for part two of our Technicolor Marathon for a discussion of the 1945 film, Leave Her to Heaven. Don't go anywhere.
I need something that's going to get people talking now.
I might have something. I've been investigating a story about young women being recruited by extremists over social media.
This is brilliant. When I grow
up. How'd you make contact?
I created a fake profile, posing as a young convert to lure one of the recruiters to me.
I'm going to share my screen.
It's kind of hot.
Do you think?
The IT guys can record your desktop.
Amy, tattoos are prohibited.
Can you see the tattoo?
No. Ready to go.
He's calling.
And I'm going to record it all.
Assalamu alaikum, my sister. Tell me about you.
You're beautiful.
In the beginning, he would be testing the waters. He's a hunter. He wants to seduce me first.
I love you!
Only then will he give me a guide into the recruitment process.
Come here. I'll give you everything you need.
A whole new life. A very happy one.
You have to believe me. It's paradise.
You're brave to admire in a man. Can I ask you what your job is?
I don't want to talk about it over the internet. There's journalists everywhere.
Journalists. And they've got no morals. They're vultures, you know?
Exactly. You're full of surprises, aren't you? Am I your type?
Yeah, you're hot.
I don't want to do the fighting and the cooking.
I'll go after you.
Babe, is everything all right?
I'm fine. If I want to come to Syria, what do I need to do?
You're making me feel happy right now.
Are you falling in love with him?
It's all just part of the recruitment process. Bika. What's the training program like for converts like us?
Hey, baby!
What are you looking at?
Nothing, I'm looking at you.
You wouldn't lie to me, would you?
Here in 2021, we spend an awful lot of time interacting with screens. Pondering humanity's relationship to technology isn't anything new for cinema. You can look at classics like 2001 A Space Odyssey, or even something newer like the 2016 Olivier Assayas film, Personal Shopper. As thematic material, it's nothing unique to look at technology, but what is unique is the handful of films from recent years that have examined our screen-filled lives by depicting the screens themselves. A new subgenre of films called screen life has emerged, telling stories that take place entirely on screens, computers, TVs, and phones, and this makes for a very memorable viewing experience. My personal introduction to this idea was an episode of Modern Family that took place entirely on a character's computer desktop, and we, as the audience, watched her browse the internet, read text messages, and make video calls to her family members. Then in 2018, I watched Searching, which is a thriller that uses the screen life format. It's about a man looking for his missing daughter. He's hacking into her email to try and find information, and he's interacting online with the detective who's working the case. In both cases, I was struck by just how much creativity this format allows and the unique storytelling that becomes possible when you restrict a film to visual depictions of digital spaces. The film Profile was just released in theaters, even though it played festivals way back in 2018. Profile is another screen life movie, but this time, the story takes on a serious political and social message. Back in 2014, where this story is set, ISIS was recruiting a lot of young women from Europe and the US, and Profile follows an investigative journalist named Amy as she goes undercover to try and find a recruiter and learn about the process from the inside. Amy ends up making contact with a terrorist, and it's fascinating to watch their interactions play out over Skype. At the same time, Amy also has an editor who's on her case to get the story out quickly. She has a best friend who she goes to for personal support, and she has a boyfriend, complete with some relationship issues. We see all of this play out on Amy's laptop screen, and there's a lot of tension and surprises along the way. The movie is successful at being thrilling, and it really keeps you on the edge of your seat. The screen life format is utilized really well, and the movie goes to some creative and unexpected places. The film is also journalistic itself. I felt like I had learned a lot about how ISIS operated at that time and why people were attracted to their cause, something that was really confusing to me before I watched this movie. I do think that some of Amy's actions in the film don't feel fully justified, and that the filmmakers could have done more to contextualize her experience and explain her motivations. The film tries to toe a certain line and keep the audience guessing as to some of the decisions she's making, and that aspect of the film really didn't work or feel very believable. As the film stands, Amy does some things that feel out of left field and out of character, and it feels like they wanted to get certain story elements into the film. It just didn't feel justified in how they got there. I'll say also that a few of the surprises weren't as surprising as they were clearly supposed to be, so that hurt the film a bit for me too. I can't go into more detail about those things without spoiling the movie, but I do overall recommend this movie. I think if you haven't seen a Screen Life movie before, Profile could be a great introduction to the genre. And while I did enjoy the film Searching from 2018 a little bit more, I had a lot of fun with this movie, and I think it's definitely worth seeing. Profile is now playing in theaters.
Baby, I bought the ticket. I'm coming.
This has gone far enough.
I'm reeling him in.
Who's there with you?
No, you say you're...
What?
My God, I'm sharing my screen.
He's a terrorist.
Oh, my God.
You know who I am? We'll find you in a matter of minutes.
No, please don't.
Delete your account.
I need to make sure there's a connection so I know where he is, if he's behind my door.
Amy.
What's going on?
I'm going to treat you like a queen.
Last time on the podcast, we started a new marathon looking at films made in Technicolor. We talked all about the Technicolor technology and the history of it, and we kicked off with a discussion of 1938's The Adventures of Robin Hood, which I really liked. You can go back and hear that in the previous episode. Rance Collins is taking us through this marathon, and he's back again today. Make sure to check out his podcast, The Envelope Please, which is all about Oscars history, and it's just a treasure trove of interesting classic film stuff. Rance Collins, welcome back again. How's it going?
It is going really, really well. It's great to be back with you. I love talking movies on the podcast.
We love having you. When I say we, I mean me. It's just me.
But you and all the other invisible people,
yes,
who are there with you.
The listeners, I do have, actually, I've had listeners say they really like when you're here because you just have so much knowledge. So yes, you, a fan favorite, maybe. I don't know. I don't know if that term applies. We can use it.
So if I'm not a fan favorite, then there
we have a problem. Something's not working here.
Yeah.
Well, besides today's movie, have you been watching anything else lately?
Well, I always have to plug my own podcast. You'll forgive me.
No,
I do have a podcast called The Envelope, Please. I'm sure you all know that by now. But I just recorded the episodes for the year 1977, in which it's the 50th anniversary of the Oscars and Annie Hall wins Best Picture. Mm. And it is a fascinating discussion about a movie that has kind of retroactively become very, very hot button,
yeah,
because of the creative person behind it. So if you're interested in hearing how we analyze that in 2021, look forward to that episode.
I'd love to hear that. And that's somewhat relevant because in the previous episode, when we talked about Robin Hood, my other guest and I talked about a movie called Together. It's a new indie dramedy. And they talk about Woody Allen in that movie and specifically Annie Hall.
Oh.
Because it's a friendship in the movie between like an older man and a younger woman. And it's not romantic. It's just like a movie about friendship. But they talk about like how people perceive them to be a couple the older guy really likes Woody Allen and she like calls him out and like they kind of have a really interesting discussion about it. Anyway, so yes, I can't wait to tune in and hear what you have to say too.
Annie Hall is a really interesting movie to unpack in 2020, as is any movie that was really, really popular when it came out, but then something or someone involved has maybe changed perceptions about the movie over time. And having freshly watched the HBO documentary Allen v. Pharaoh, it was a weird watch. Let's just put it that way.
I haven't watched that HBO documentary yet. I want to. I'm also kind of nervous too. I haven't prioritized it yet, but I hope to watch
it. Yeah, I don't know what your feelings are on Woody Allen, but they will definitely change in some way after you watch that documentary.
Interesting.
So,
yeah.
But speaking of HBO, I'm also watching their new TV show, half-hour comedy called Hacks, which has Gene Smart in it. And Gene Smart has one of like the best careers of any human being on the planet, because I mean, she's just shy of 70 now and has for the first time ever her own TV show. But she's been kind of a TV staple for decades.
Yeah, you know, she's everything. In so many things. And yeah, it's wild that she hasn't had like a lead thing really before.
She's three things on HBO right now. She was in Watchmen, and then she was in the Kate Winslet miniseries that just
Mayor of Easttown. Yeah.
Yes. And but then previously, I mean, she won an Emmy for a guest spot on Frasier. She was on a show. She also won an Emmy for a show called Samantha Who. She also was on Designing Women, which was a big sitcom back in the day. She was on 24. She was on Fargo, you know.
She's all over the place.
And then she's been in some movies, too. And yeah, I'm just it's really nice to see somebody who has been such a consistently amazing presence on television for so long really get a good headliner role. And it's such a caustic, like sarcastic, biting comedy that I highly recommend it. It'll get so many award nominations, so you should go watch it now.
Yes, I should. Yeah, I saw her. I hadn't seen her in a while, and then saw her in Watchmen, and I was like, man, she's such a good actor. I'm so glad
it's just so weird to me, because most actors, I mentioned this to someone else, you know, for most people, having being part of an ensemble in a hit sitcom in the late 80s, early 90s, like that's your career. That's what you're known for the rest of your life. You know, for most people who are in that situation. But she's gone on to do some really amazing things, which is incredible. I will also say that the actress Annie Potts, who was on Designing Women, has also had you know, she's on Young Sheldon now.
Oh, interesting.
And she also was in Ghostbusters and all that. So there are, I'm not saying that the other people on that show didn't have good careers. I'm saying that it's so unusual that somebody like Gene Smart existed first in the cultural zeitgeist and something like that. And that wasn't the end of her career. Yeah. All this other stuff happened afterwards. Yeah. So.
I hear Annie Potts' voice all the time because she plays Bo Peep on Toy Story.
That's right. And
we
always totally
have those on repeat here in my house.
I mean, Annie Potts, getting in Bo Peep in Toy Story might have been, like, I imagine that was a good payday for her. And has continued to be so.
Yeah, and she's like a big part of the fourth one, too. So, yeah, she's...
Well, she wasn't in the third one, and then they brought her... You know, they brought her back and a whole feminist streak in the fourth one. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway.
Well, cool.
This is a movie podcast, right? I forgot.
We're talking lots of TV and kids movies. If it's on the screen, I think it works.
On the screen. Are you watching anything different than you were?
Not a ton more. I was looking back. I watched a bunch of stuff this week. I was busy. I was actually a judge for the Made in Arkansas Film Festival, which is really cool. And basically that meant I just watched almost everything in the festival early, all the things that were like nominees, I guess. And
can I
kind of rated them.
Yeah. Insert something real quickly? Yeah. So Minari, which was fantastic, would not qualify for being made in Arkansas, even though it takes place in Arkansas, because it was made in Oklahoma. Is that correct?
I think that's true, although I think they, at this point, it's like if one of the major filmmakers is from Arkansas or one of the major actors is from Arkansas, like I think they have like an Arkansas connection series, and maybe those aren't for competition. They're just like... they just show them, but then there's certain ones that are competing as well. And there's this year they had a little bit less content just because of No, the pandemic. But there were three features that I watched, and I had a bunch of short films. And it's always great. There's like a student block, so it's like student films. So it's cool to see some of the people coming out of UCA, and always a lot of promising filmmakers, it feels like we have in this area. So yes, Made in Arkansas is a cool festival. It's sounds over like it. At this point, but they've been doing it every year. So hopefully we'll be back in person next year. They do it at Ron Robinson downtown. So. Keep in tune for that for next year. But I watched some good stuff for that. I could highlight another movie from a previous episode. I talked about the Kaleidoscope Festival. Another one that I didn't talk about there that was really good is called Pariah, which is actually, it's from 2011. It's an older film, but it's directed by Dee Reese. And it's about a young woman who... she's gay, and she basically, it's just like code switching to the max. She has her kind of lesbian community that she is a part of, and friends she really loves and cares for there, and then her family's pretty conservative, church going, and she kind of has to wear different hats, and eventually that pressure just, she can't take it anymore, and it kind of explodes. It's a really, really good movie. It's really moving. It's on Netflix, actually, so you can watch that really easily, and I will recommend that. They usually at the Kaleidoscope Festival show like something significant from that's not, you know, brand new or forthcoming, and that was the one this year, and it's really, really good. So that is Pariah. And then actually on the first half of this episode we're recording now, I had a review of a movie called Profile, which is it played festivals in 2018, but it just now is hitting theaters. But it's one of these screen life movies where the whole movie takes place on a screen. So you're seeing, you know, text messages and Zoom calls and stuff.
Oh.
And the story unfolds that way. There's another one that was pretty significant a couple years ago called Searching. And that one is
Was there one with Deborah Messing?
Deborah Messing and John Cho is looking for his daughter who's disappeared. And I really like it. I think it's probably not for everyone, but it's almost becoming this like subgenre. There's a couple like horror movies. Unfriended is there's like a couple of those. That are kind of in this format, and it's really interesting. It's like a really different kind of experience watching a movie like that, especially on the big screen. I went to the theater down the road, had Profile. Profile is about, it's set in 2014. So at this point, ISIS recruiting a lot of people from young women from the UK and the US. And some of them are traveling to Syria, and it looks at that. It follows an investigative journalist who basically goes undercover and tries to connect with a terrorist and like write a report about it, and is successful in that. And she also has some personal problems happening, and we see all that on her computer screen. And it's really pretty thrilling. I really liked it. You can listen to the full review, but I had a few kind of issues with it, but I think it's pretty good, and definitely recommend checking it out if it's playing in a theater near you. And if it's playing here in Little Rock, I imagine it's playing everywhere, so you can catch that in the theater.
Well, now that our theaters are back.
Yes, exactly.
Because we didn't have movies. You guys were ahead of us for a while. For a whole year, you had more movies than we did.
Yes, and California's had it rough.
We did. But we also now have the lowest positivity rate and one of the highest vaccination rates in the country. So
really? Interesting.
Yes. Yes.
Well, things are looking up, and that's very good.
They are. And as of this recording today, I am officially 2 weeks out from my second shot. So
nice. Very good.
Thank you. I don't know how I feel. I kind of had gotten used to not ever having to see people.
You know, right? It's like I have to be social again. What? Yeah.
I was gonna say that the format of a screen being the visual, I guess you could say. First of all, I think it's a really interesting idea for filmmakers today, because I feel like the way that you keep people from looking away from a movie screen is to have as much activity going on as they would if they had their phone in their hand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But second of all, the first time I remember seeing something like that was actually an episode probably 6 years ago, maybe, of Modern Family.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually mentioned that in my review, too. There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
It's perfect.
The Connection Lost, I think, is the name of the episode. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I remember the name of the episode. I don't know the names of any other episode. I think I just, like, was so specifically impressed with that episode. It was one of my favorites
it's
of that
Claire,
show.
Right? And she's like, so she's like FaceTiming people, and I can't remember what the story is, but it's like, it's unique and it's funny and it's really creative.
They can't find Haley.
Oh, that's right.
Her daughter Haley. And it turns out, you know, she was like in the house the entire time.
Like sleeping in the basement. Like, or something.
The Find My iPhone had her phone in Vegas at a wedding chapel, and like, and they found that she had been searching for something that was like baby related on Amazon. So they thought, oh no, she's pregnant, and she got married, and then the whole time she just overslept in the basement of their house.
That's right. I remembered that. I didn't remember all the details of that, but I remembered watching that, and yeah, it really stuck out. Yeah. Yeah. It's like a thing now. I think it's gonna probably, filmmakers will keep doing it. When Searching came out, I did quite a bit of research. I mean, I just read about it, and it's not as simple as just recording the screen. Like, they're recreating this all digitally, and apparently, like, you know how film editing, there's like layers of things, and apparently it's just like they talked about having to like buy faster and faster computers to be able to handle all the things they were creating digitally, which is funny. I remember I was watching Searching at someone else in the theater. It was like me and like an old couple, and they made a comment like 10 minutes in when they realized, oh, this is all on a screen. Apparently they didn't know that going in. And the woman said, well, I guess they didn't spend much money on this movie. like assuming they just, oh, we'll just put this on the computer. So I think that's a compliment in a way, because it feels like, it just feels like a real computer when it's actually like being completely recreated. Anyway.
Yeah. It's a fascinating premise. There's also a documentary, I think, that is something along that line that I was thinking about watching. Like, I think it's called like Why Did You Kill Me or something like that. Yeah, it's on it. I may be completely wrong, but I remember there's also a documentary. Excuse me. Because I watch a lot of murder documentaries. Just you can judge me however you want to. I feel like every time there's Netflix drops a new one like every week, and every single time, you know, my roommate will start watching it, and he'll be like, did you see this one yet? anyway, so there was one, it's called like The American Family or something like that. And it's about this, wife who goes missing, and then they find out she's been murdered, but the entire story is told without the usual talking head interviews or narration. It's all told through archival footage and vlogs that this woman did leading up to it, and text messages that are on the screen. And
interesting. Is it American Murder, The Family Next Door? Is that the one?
Yes, that's the one. Okay. That's the one. Yeah, it's really disturbing, but it's told in a way that's really interesting, because you don't have, you know, the usual, like, you know, sitting down with the lead detective and he says this, that, and the other. And, you know, it's not it's just told in real time using text and some like archival footage from like news broadcast or cell phones and everything. So anyway.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting.
That's a side conversation about.
No, I love it. And I'm going to bring something else up. So this is like the longest what have you been watching segment ever, but I'm fine with it. Another, it's a true crime-esque documentary. It's on Hulu right now, and it's the Duplass brothers produce it. It's called Sasquatch. And I've only watched the first of the three episodes, but it's really interesting. Basically, a guy is remembering a story years ago that, like in the early 90s, I think, he was working on a weed farm, and some people rushed in and were like, our friends were just murdered by Sasquatch. And like, he remembers that really specifically, and he never found out what the truth of that situation was. So he's investigating that. And so it's talking to people who believe in Sasquatch and all kinds of stuff. And I'm at this funny place where I feel like I keep having these like stories about like scary stories told in the woods or in the forest, like way out in the middle of nowhere. And like a few different movies and things I've read and stuff all have that kind of a premise. So I'm like right in the right spot to like watch this Sasquatch thing. And, you know, I always just assume Sasquatch is fake, and he probably is. But watching this documentary, I'm like, I don't know. It could be. It could be a real thing. that's the weird place that I'm in right now. But it's a really interesting show.
You know, this is actually, I think it's kind of appropriate that we've been talking so much about murdery things. Yes. Because, I mean, this leads right into the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Like, when they go out in the middle of the woods in this movie, I was like, here we are again. Another dark tale in the woods.
This is quite the dark tale, although you wouldn't know it looking at any individual frame.
Yes, absolutely. So that's a perfect transition. Let's leave all the Sasquatch talk behind and let's talk about today's movie, Leave Her to Heaven.
What shall be done with a jealous woman?
Jacques Dunchild, if you were having the baby, you'd love it. Well, I never wanted it. Richard and I never needed anything else. And now this.
How can you say such wicked things?
Sometimes the truth is wicked.
The starring roles of Jean Tierney long ago revealed her as an incomparable dramatic artist. But in the part of Ellen in Leave Her to Heaven, she gives one of the truly great dramatic performances of our time. Of the devastatingly beautiful Ellen, it was said, she would cheat, lie, deceive, stop at nothing to make the man she loved her exclusive possession. With matchless dramatic power and romantic appeal, Cornell Wilde surpasses all his previous triumphs. As Richard Harlan, he fights his mad desire to marry Ellen.
Now look here, Ellen.
Darling, will you marry me?
Why, you unpredictable little...
All right, let's talk about Leave Her to Heaven. So as Rance was just saying, this is a film noir, or you're saying it's a surprisingly dark story. It is surprisingly dark. It definitely has a lot of elements of noir, and we could talk about, you know, whether it fits into that category exactly. But the story is about a troubled marriage, basically, and kind of the issues it causes for the rest of the family. So in the film, it follows a writer named Richard Harland. He's traveling to New Mexico when he sees a beautiful woman on the train reading one of his books. And he talks to her. Her name is Ellen Barrett. And they strike up a conversation. They have kind of an instant connection. Turns out they're going to the same place. And after they spend a little time getting to know each other, she announces her intent to marry him, even though she'll have to break off her engagement to another man.
Are you going to mention who the other man is? Because isn't the other man Vincent Price? Vincent Price.
It is, yeah. Vincent Price. Oh my God. Yes. I didn't even realize that. Wow.
I know. He's so young, you don't even like think about.
Yeah. Totally different persona. And like before, in that final scene, I can see it now, like in my mind, but like, oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. No. They kind of made him into it. It's his career is so interesting because, you know, in the 40s, they're trying to make him into this kind of, second lead, good looking dude, you know, noble guy on top of that. And then, you know, his career takes a hard turn in the 50s after House of Wax. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely noticed his face and thought like he was kind of striking. And now I'm realizing that, of course, that was Vincent Price. Yeah. Wow. That's really amazing. So to finish that thought, she breaks off her engagement from Vincent Price, who's playing Russell Quinton in this movie. And the first like half hour or so, this movie are like mostly really pleasant. They get married. They're happy. They take care of Richard's brother, who he has a disability from having polio, and he uses a wheelchair or he uses some crutches to get around. And so that's kind of the life they set up. Then they travel, as we mentioned, to the middle of the woods, way out in the middle of nowhere, to Richard's family cabin, and things get dark from there. A lot of jealousy and deception and crime happening, and it's a hard turn from the mostly really kind of almost happy-go-lucky beginning of this movie. So that's kind of the basic setup. I don't know, I guess we can talk about some of the spoilery things later, but let's talk about the Technicolor side of it first. So I can't imagine that a lot of Technicolor films kind of fit into the noir genre, but I may be wrong about that. Is that what's the relationship between Technicolor and noir?
I mean, you know, it's not something that springs to mind immediately for people because noir, you usually think of those hard lines and shadows with, you know, like a really smoky screen and monochrome and the shadow of blinds over, you know, a femme fatale's face. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of what you think of when you think of a film noir. But Leave Her to Heaven is considered by many. I mean, the thing is, film noir is so difficult to define. There's often debate about what constitutes it. And, you know, once you get away from the Maltese Falcons and double indemnities of the world, you get a lot of debate over what technically constitutes film noir. But a lot of people consider Leave Her to Heaven to be an example of a color noir because it does have the dark, murdery, backstabby crime elements that are so prevalent in the its genre is not the correct word in the movement.
Okay,
there you go. Oh, it's LA, so somebody apparently has broken out of a car and is being hotly pursued by a helicopter. Okay.
Wow. gotta love LA.
There's a helicopter overhead for some reason.
That's probably what's going on.
Crime everywhere.
You're living in a film noir right now.
I'm living in a film noir. A hot pursuit is happening. Anyway, so yes, I personally do think that it does constitute as a film noir, and I know that there is a lot of debate as opposed to whether or not it does, but it does. I mean, if Wikipedia says in its main entry it's a psychological thriller film noir directed by John Stahl, then it
must be true.
It must be true because Wikipedia said it's true. So
yeah, no, I absolutely think it fits. You know, and I haven't seen, you know, as many film noir probably as you have, but yeah, it has the dark, gritty kind of story happening, and it's in a package that is kind of unexpected, which I think only makes it kind of hit harder in a way. The only other kind of color noir film I think I've seen is a modern film. It's Brick. From Ryan Johnson, which it's like an homage to film noir, so it's like trying to do that on purpose. And it's a really, I think it's a solid movie, but
and it's more overt about it because it's mimicking a dialogue style and a storyline that's very stereotypically noir, because it is homage, because so of course it's doing that, but Leave Her to Heaven is not as cut and dry because, as you mentioned, you know, the first part of it, it's just like it's where it's like a psychological thriller because it just plants seeds of something's off.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing I love about it is the more you know about what happens, the more you wonder, like, how random was it that they met? You know, Did she actually just happen to run into him? How did her father die? Like, you know.
Yeah, I did have that thought for sure. Mm-hmm. I did think this is a good movie to watch a second time, knowing the ending and kind of unlocking a little more to it. But yeah, that's, I didn't think about even their meeting. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a random coincidence that you have to wonder, like, I don't believe that this woman has random coincidences. I think that she plans out everything, you know?
Yeah. Wow. So we're talking about how dark this movie is. It's pretty shocking even for now. And I can't imagine, like, at the time, it must have been incredibly shocking. Do you know much about kind of the reception this film got at the time?
Well, you know, this is a period. Do we need to give more of a plot summary so people understand? Or are we allowed to be spoiler-y?
I guess so. Yeah. Let's go ahead and spoil it. I guess it's fine.
Okay, so here, I'm just going to say, spoiler.
Yeah, if you don't want to know any of the things that happen in this, stop. But we kind of
have,
we kind of have to give this movie a fair discussion. So yes, go ahead, Rance.
So basically, after they're married, things start to go dark. They're taking care of his his younger brother, and essentially anything that takes attention away from her annoys Ellen. And so Ellen, the brother who is disabled, she's taking him out for swims in this lake in the woods. And then one day she just encourages him to keep swimming as she rows alongside him in the boat. And she then allows him to drown in what is probably one of the most shocking and terrifying scenes of the period.
Yeah, my mouth was on the floor because it was, I had a sense like she was planning something, but I didn't know how far she was going to go with that. Yeah, anyway.
It is so, it's so quiet and subtle the way it happens, you know? It's so, because, you know, he just like tries to come up for air a couple times and she just sits there, doesn't move, has on these sunglasses that just totally shield her eyes. And she's wearing like a bathrobe and
she puts white. The shades on, and that's an interesting moment. I think it's the only time she wears the sunglasses, and it's kind of an iconic look a little bit. And
it's a great shot too,
like of her going bad, kind of a Breaking Bad kind of a feeling in that moment.
It's the point of no return, to be sure.
As I recall, there's not even any music playing, I don't think, or maybe there is, but you would expect maybe like a big shocking music for like a movie at this time, but it's like silent and you're just like listening to it all happen. It's rough
and it's chills. It is a jaw drop moment. You don't expect anyone, especially in the 1940s, to go this dark.
Yeah.
So quick. And then
the next dark thing is even more surprising, perhaps.
It is. So then you would think that this obsessive woman who wants nothing more than her husband's attention would welcome a child that would attach her to the husband forevermore. But no. She starts to realize that the husband is going to love this baby perhaps more than her. And give it more attention. Everyone's talking about it and not her. And so then she is standing at the top of the staircase and she realizes that she could induce a miscarriage if she throws herself down. And so she throws herself down the stairs and has a miscarriage.
That was another point. Like just based on the year that this came out, I was like, they're not going to do that in this movie. And then they did it. And yeah, it was really, really surprising.
This is where, of course, well, then to just complete the, basically she ends up killing herself. She does it in a way that implicates her sister for murder. And then the sister has to go through a trial and they have to make sure it's clear that it's suicide, basically. But because this is the production code, we kind of have to go through all of that at the end, you know, to make sure that everybody who committed a crime.
Yeah, got justice. Accountable. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about like there's like a framing device where he's just gotten out of jail at the beginning, and then someone's telling the story. But I guess that's why they did that, to see he went to jail because he knew about these crimes and didn't tell. And yeah,
like, and that's just on. You know, and I can't. This is based on a novel. I don't know how much it diverted from the original novel. They came out the same year, and apparently this novel was bought for $100,000 by 20th Century Fox in 1945, which is an outrageous sum. Excuse me, it came out in 44, movie 45. But they bought it before the release, which is, you know, they must have like seen, you know, early, the galleys, as they call it. You see the galleys of a novel. That's a term. I don't know if
I'm seeing movie potential for it, basically.
Yes. So they bought it for $100,000, which was a huge sum in 1944. And then it ended up being a big hit book. So it was a smart move. And then they you know, so I don't know how much it diverted. I'm assuming that it was, if it was a recent hit, they probably stayed relatively close. Mm-hmm. But I know that the production code would come into play. And there are a lot of elements of the end of this and the way that people are held accountable that do feel like the way the production code would dictate something. Hmm. So, because, you know, you're not supposed to get away with crimes, basically, mm-hmm. as far as the production code goes. So,
yeah, it's interesting, too. There's like a there's almost like a tradition now in thriller movies of, you know, someone trying to get at someone from beyond the grave, like in their dying act, they're going to take someone else out. And this is a cool, like,
including,
yeah, something recent. Is that what you're thinking?
Picture nominee.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, well, obviously the character is evil in Leave Her to Heaven, not the case in Promising Young Woman, mm-hmm. But it is the beyond the grave aspect of it does recall Leave Her to Heaven.
Definitely thought of that movie as I was watching this, for sure.
I was wondering. I can't think of the screenwriter's name off the top of my head.
Emerald Fennell.
Yeah. I wondered if she had seen Leave Her to Heaven, because it was a similar.
Yeah.
But then it also has, you know, elements of like a Gone Girl, hmm. you know, you can see the thread of this character later on. And this is a movie that was hugely successful. It was the highest grossing film for 20th Century Fox in the decade of the 1940s.
Wow.
So, this was a very, very popular movie, and Gene Tierney was kind of Fox's biggest star at this point in time. She had come onto the scene strong with a film noir called Laura the year before, which also has Vincent Price playing a scorned lover of hers.
Interesting.
and then she kept making a lot of good movies in the 40s and 50s, but this is kind of her peak. And she did get an Oscar nomination for this movie, playing this incredible, this character that is not remotely redeemable.
Yeah, really not at all. Yeah. Wow. I didn't realize she won, or so she was nominated for acting. Yeah. Wow.
Yes, she was nominated. She lost to another film noir performance. She lost to Joan Crawford and Mildred Pierce. Mm. Which is one of the ultimate film noirs, which you brought up something. This movie is told in flashback, and that is another trope of the movement, because, you know, Double Indemnity is a very good example.
We talked about that one last year.
And Mildred Pierce is told in flashback. Sunset Boulevard is told in flashback. Mm-hmm. You know, those are all movies that start at a point and then you go back to see how you got to that point. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about Cornell Wilde? What else is he in? What's he known for? He plays Richard in this.
He was kind of a very reliable male lead at 20th Century Fox, where he was under contract for years and years and years. He actually did get an Oscar nomination this year for a different movie called A Song to Remember. I can't comment on that, but he was because I haven't seen it. Okay. But he was Hungarian by birth. Obviously you wouldn't know that because he doesn't have an accent. He immigrated to America in New York City specifically when he was about 3 years old. So he grew up in America but was born in Hungary. And he made a lot of movies, was often used as kind of an exotic character because, you know, he had that whole, I guess, Hungarian vibe. And at the time, Hollywood would think that anything that was, you know, that Eastern European would mean like, oh, you can play anything that
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Any other ethnicity. So, you know, he often has little accents in his various movies. He was in a Best Picture winner that is absolutely awful called The Greatest Show on Earth. Where he plays a Hungarian, like, trapeze artist. And the only thing that is worth recommending for that movie is for women and gay men who want to see Cornel Wilde shirtless for half of that movie. And in his little, you know, trapeze tights. And that is the only thing that I recommend about that movie. But he is in a ton of movies throughout that period. And so is the other, the kind of third lead of this movie, Jean Crane. She became a big, big star at 20th Century Fox after Leave Her to Heaven. She had kind of made her first splash that same year, playing the lead in a 1945 version of State Fair, which is, you know, one of the first Rodgers and Hammerstein film adaptations. And so she was also a singer as well. She wasn't. She was dubbed in that movie. So she was also a person who could mouth to singing. She then just starred in a bunch of movies that were pretty successful at Fox. She got an Oscar nomination for a movie called Pinky, in which she plays half black.
Interesting.
Yes, which, again, this is the casting of the 1940s, which was problematic. Although the story is being about race relations in a kind of progressive way, having a big role for a very storied black actress who was in Cabin in the Sky and some other stuff, Ethel Waters. So it's a complicated movie about somebody who's passing, basically. And it's by Elia Kazan, who, of course, made lots of interesting movies in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And then you have A Letter to Three Wives, which won director and screenplay for Joseph Mankiewicz in 1949. And she was in the original Cheaper by the Dozen, playing the eldest daughter.
A long time ago. Yeah, interesting.
She's the eldest daughter in that one. She was in a quasi sequel to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes called Gentlemen Marry Brunettes.
Interesting.
Yeah, so she had a very successful career and was a headlining actress for a very, very long time. So I just wanted to mention her because her career was so successful.
Yeah, she's really good in this too. Yeah.
Oh, she's great. You can see why she became a star, because she definitely has a quality about her.
Yeah, I was going to mention on about Cornel Wilde, and you kind of mentioned his attractiveness. He's a really handsome guy, and there's a little bit, like, there's nothing overt at all. Really, I mean, there actually is one scene where there's, it seems like she just wants to be alone with him. Like, if you look at the poster of this on IMDb, that's steamier than anything in the movie, probably. But it's there is some kind of sexual tension, which is another thing I just didn't quite expect from this movie. But that's
it. Well, I mean, Jean Tierney is, first of all, Jean Tierney is one of the most beautiful
she's gorgeous.
Women in film. And if anybody was ever made for Technicolor, I mean, good Lord, you know, she looks luminous the entire movie.
Yeah.
And if you were to see a still from this and didn't know what a horrible person she was, you would think, like, what a beautiful character.
Yeah, I think the Technicolor really works on, there's several close-ups of her that are really striking. And then also, there's a lot of just landscapes that are really nice. I was trying to think, like, as far as the color goes, the landscapes themselves were, I'm just imagining watching this at the time in the theater, I'm like, wow, seeing this forest in color is a kind of still being a novel thing. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, it's a real showcase for the format, honestly. Because you have, it's interesting, John M. Stahl, the director of this movie, this is the only movie I believe he even directed that was in color.
Hmm.
So you would think watching it that this was somebody who was like a total master of the format, you know, but he this is the only time he did it. And he was otherwise known for pretty melodramatic movies. Hmm. He was known for he did the original version of another movie that is about a black woman passing as white, called Imitation of Life. That's the side story, I should say. That's the progressive side of the story. There is also a story that involves a white character. That's kind of the primary story. But the secondary story is the reason to watch that movie, because it is not something you expect to see in 1934. Hmm. And he actually casted a light-skinned black woman to play that role. Her name was Freddie Washington. And she has a humongously amazing film, civil rights activist history as well. So I'm mentioning her name so you can go look up Freddie Washington. But so he dealt with that movie. He also did this melodrama called Magnificent Obsession and another one called When Tomorrow Comes. All three of those were later remade by Douglas Sirk, who was the big melodrama director of the 1950s.
Yeah, I was just saying Magnificent Obsession. I was like, that can't be the same one, right? And I was just saying, yeah, it's a remake.
Yeah, they had original versions in the 30s, and then they took those and a good story.
Yeah.
A good story works. So he was known for these melodrama movies. He seems perfect for this type of thing. But I mean, I think it's interesting. You kind of take this guy who would have been thought of as like a woman's film director of that period, you know, and you put that lusciousness, that style, that level of melodrama, and you pair it with this super dark story, and then you cast this incredibly beautiful woman, who she's brilliant. I don't even know how to put it. She's just like such a.
She's great in this.
She's so charming that you don't see it coming as a viewer how dark she's going to get. She doesn't telegraph that she's a horrible person, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then you look back and it all makes sense because all of the things that were kind of weird, you're like, huh.
It's like,
I guess I should have seen that coming. But she was so pretty, I didn't see it.
Right at the same time as she's seducing us, but in the most like innocent, she seems like a wonderful person kind of a way. Yeah, and that can't be easy to pull off, and she does an amazing job.
What an interesting commentary, too, on how we perceive beauty in society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
You know? Yeah. Because when somebody is good-looking, we'll just kind of like let them get away with murder. You know what I'm saying? It's like
literally in this case, yeah.
You know, in this case, it's literal. But she, man, and I just love looking back and like thinking, like I'd love to. I need to watch this again with the thought in my mind: did she kill her father? Did she intend for this run-in to actually happen? Because I bet you there are layers to that.
There is one line that her mother says late in the film about, or maybe her sister, something about father, and it's really vague, but I definitely I recall something about that, so I want to go back and listen to that again too now. But yeah, wow.
Yeah. Oh, and not her mother, but her there are a couple I just wanted to mention. I apparently can't form a sentence. Hold on a second. Dr. Saunders is one of the characters in the movies. He's played by a guy named Gene Lockhart, who is one of the more like prominent character actors of this period. So you got another one there. He played Bob Cratchit in the 30s version of A Christmas Carol.
Okay.
He's also in His Girl Friday and Meet John Doe and Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. Going My Way, which was a Best Picture winner. And he had a daughter named June Lockhart, who I've met.
Cool.
She's still alive. She's in her 90s. And she was best known for being Lassie's mom on the TV show Lassie. And then she was on the original version of Lost in Space in the 60s. And she had a great career. But the whole Lockhart family is like one of those acting families that has generations of actors. And then Chill Wills is in the movie, and he's a very prominent character actor who's in a whole bunch of Westerns and just like had this incredible career. So this movie is loaded with, I'm mentioning these names, just going to say this movie is loaded with a great supporting cast of people who are faces that you'll see all throughout this period in film.
Yeah. I'm just realizing too, Danny is played by Daryl Hickman, who is still alive, and he's in Network and a bunch of stuff too. Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah. I can't believe I didn't mention he was he is in Network. He slows down in the 50s, but then he like comes up for Network and like just happens to be in this incredible movie, but he's one of the more recognizable character. And he had a brother named Dwayne Hickman, who was known for playing a character named Dobie Gillis on this popular TV show called The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, and was in a whole bunch of other TV shows in that period. So got a lot of acting families represented in this. Gene Tierney.
Cast, yeah. Go ahead.
Gene Tierney, just going back to her for a second. She also she had kind of a slightly tragic life. Mm. She was pregnant during World War II. June 43. She came in contact with a fan who had rubella. The woman apparently broke quarantine to come and see her because she was such a fan. She ended up giving birth to her daughter prematurely. And her daughter was born deaf, partially blind, mentally disabled. And it was apparently because of the disease.
Wow.
And so she dealt with that guilt, I guess, for the rest of her life, and had apparently suicide attempts and it took years and years and years to get better. She did eventually kind of have a nice end to her life, but she did suffer a lot of mental problems on her own. Depression, I think, is probably a better way to put it. But that entire situation ended up being the basis for the plot of an Agatha Christie novel called The Mirror Cracked from Side to Side.
Wow.
Which became a movie called The Mirror Cracked, which starred Angela Lansbury as Mrs. Marple. Or Miss Marple, and also had Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, Kim Novak, and some other. I know. That's just like this ridiculous. It was like 1980. You know, Tony Curtis is in it. Geraldine Chaplin. It's like a really stacked cast. But it's based on this incident that happened with Gene Tierney. After Gene Tierney kind of had like this rough period, she did have something of a comeback in the early 60s when she appeared in a movie called Advise and Consent, which was a Otto Preminger film Otto Preminger had directed her in Laura, which was kind of her big break. All-star cast, Congress movie that dealt with whether or not they're going to confirm a Secretary of State who has committed perjury, because there's like this whole hidden past situation that deals with previous homosexual relationships. And it came out in the early 60s. So she had a very interesting career. And that's also one of the very few movies that Betty White is in, because she's usually in TV shows. So I just took you on such a journey.
Yeah, all over the place. That's super interesting. Where that was going. No, that's all so interesting. And so as a parent of kids with disabilities, I can say that like that's an issue. Like the mental health of parents with kids with disabilities has long been an issue, and it's finally getting more attention nowadays. I don't have anything else to add to that other than to say that describes me in a way. So that's kind of an interesting connection too.
Well, I mean, it's so difficult. I mean, like this is just now. Because like people are just now learning how to talk about things in a way that's respectful. Yeah. Just talk about things in a way that's respectful. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
let alone support parents and or
how many times did you hear? Yeah, how many times did you hear slurs?
Oh yeah,
used as the butt of a joke on sitcoms in the 90s. You know,
yeah,
and so I can't even imagine what it must have been like for. To go through that type of thing in the 40s and 50s when there's literally no knowledge or education on a mass level to speak of. So
yeah, we have to blame women for things too. So yeah, you can imagine the guilt that you mentioned, the guilt she must have felt. And yeah,
man. they probably are like, oh, that crazy woman, you know, she's, you know, oh, did you hear Jean Tierney had to go to a mental hospital because she blah, 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 blah. Yeah. You know, like I can only imagine what the slander must have been like for her.
Wow.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
Well,
but she plays a great evil person.
yeah. Great actor. And yeah, so amazing in this movie. I guess I can bring us back around to kind of wrapping up, but, this movie is really, really strong. I'm so glad that I've seen it and highly recommend it. If anyone's listening who hasn't watched it, and as mentioned, it's on YouTube. That's where I watched it. I bet it will eventually come back. I think there's a Criterion disc too. I'll double check that, but.
Yes, it is available, I think on Criterion. This movie is one of thousands that just came under the purview of Disney because 20th Century Fox was bought out by Disney. So I'm sure that Disney, I would imagine, is sorting out their library and figuring out how to release all this content they didn't previously have access to, because this isn't exactly something that's going to fit the Disney Plus bill.
Yeah, they've already like censored their some things on there. This isn't gonna fit in quite right. Yeah,
so. Maybe Hulu, maybe they can put it on Hulu one day, because they do own Hulu as well. So
well, we can hope it becomes more widely available. Until then, you can get it on physical disc or a bootleg copy on YouTube. That is Leave Her to Heaven. Next time, we are going to look at The Red Shoes, which I've never seen, but I've always wanted to. So I'm excited to watch that. Any preview information on that? It is a musical, correct?
It is. And I know very little about it because this is actually going to be my first time watching it too.
Well, cool. It's directed by Powell and Pressburger, who are a directing duo. And I don't know that much about them either, but I'll learn before next time. But they have quite a legacy, I think. So I'm excited to watch this one.
Me too. Let's do it.
And it is streaming on HBO Max. So that one's easy to watch if you've got an HBO subscription. All right. Well, I guess that'll wrap us up for this time. Thanks so much, Rance. This was full of information and so interesting. Always appreciate you being here.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
As always, huge, huge thanks to Rance Collins for always being willing to come and bestow his knowledge upon us. He's obviously the MVP when it comes to these classic movie marathons. Thank you so much, Rance. Next time, we will continue our Technicolor series by looking at 1948 musical The Red Shoes. This is one that I've never seen and I've always wanted to, so I'm really excited to watch this in the next few weeks and discuss with Rance next time. I'll also review something new. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to be just yet. I'll try to tweet that out when I know. That is still in development. And with that, thank you for listening to Art House Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now. You can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more at www.appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Art House Garage, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Art House Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Art House Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Art House Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob-free.